Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Eltzeri, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we got on our agenda today?
Yeah, so we got a lot, even though the federal government shutdown is delaying many data sources, data is still being released. So we'll be looking at a lot of data from private providers and trade orgs. We'll be covering some labor market indicators, some consumer data, the broader financial market conditions data, as well as some recently released small business data. And before we end the call, we'll be also highlighting some CRE credit trends, both from the research team and what we're seeing, as well as we have a guest, Andrew Pabone, from our Altus Debt Advisory business, dropping in to share some insights. So I'll kick it off first with some of the labor market indicators that we've seen. So with the Fed government shutdown ongoing and no clear end in sight, at least as of Tuesday when we're recording this, there's been a rather major disruption in key data flows, especially within the labor market reporting. However, on October 10th, the Kansas City Fed did publish a restricted version of that Fed's labor market condition indicator index, which is the LMCI, which uses 11 of the 24 variables from the original LMCI and excludes the 13 that are delayed from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. What I thought was really interesting about this revised and kind of alternative measure is that it does provide a pretty solid, timely estimate of the labor market conditions that could be used really to, rather than grabbing one-off report, one-off indicators that are published, this is a pretty good, even if only a portion of the broader labor market conditions data that exists. So first, the restricted level of activity indicator, which measures the overall health of the labor market, showed a decline from 0.06 to 0.0 in September. So that means that this indicator reached its historical average. The official and restricted versions of this indicator have a very strong correlation of 0.99 prior to the pandemic. If this relationship holds, even with this restricted data, it's still showing and capturing much of the activity within the labor market that would have been captured in the outstanding 13 other indicators. The second component of the LMCI is the momentum indicator, which really measures the pace of change in the labor market. And in September, this increased by 0.18 from a negative 0.88 to a negative 0.7. Now, while this reading is below the historical average of zero, it is within typical standard deviation. So I know I just dumped a new indicator and a revised version of that indicator. And so you might be asking, so what? Or tell me something I don't know. By using the restricted LMCI, the authors provided real-time forecast for September's labor market. Working with the restricted LMCI set, the authors then forecast payroll growth and unemployment. These are two very important signals and key inputs into the Fed's decision on future rate cuts or just policy rate movements. So the authors forecast that the economy added an average of 60,000 jobs per month from July to September, which would be a slight acceleration from the official three-month average of 29,000 from June to August. And the forecast coming out of this restricted LMCI suggests an unemployment rate of 4.4% for September 2025. That's a slight increase from the 4.3% official unemployment rate seen in August. But more importantly, it's a further sign of labor market softening, which would be supportive of a rate cut at the next October 29th Fed Day decision. I think this is going to be an interesting indicator to watch going forward, given its really impressive and significant kind of correlation with the index before it was restricted. And I think this is a kind of a key metric that I'll certainly be watching to better understand kind of some of the labor market movements and kind of the overall labor market condition as we go into the Fed day. But the labor market is not the only data that's out there. We got a boatload of consumer data that's still being reported on. And I know that, Cole, you've been neck deep in that data. What were some of the key takeaways on the consumer front?
Yeah, so I've got a whole slew of them here for you. But the good news is that the Federal Reserve is still putting out a lot of their data sets. And so we did get, on October 7th, the G19 or the Consumer Credit Report. And then the New York Fed puts out their survey of consumer expectations, which we also got on the same day. That's covering the month of September. And then last Friday, we got the preliminary results of the Consumer Sentiment Index from the University of Michigan for October. So good news is that these all came out sequentially, and we're going to talk through them sequentially, covering a few different months. So keep in mind that there's some data lag here, but I think if you take them all together, we get a pretty good picture of what might be going on with the consumer broadly. But we'll start with that consumer credit data. So the Fed released the G19 for August on the 7th, showing total U.S. consumer credit rose at just 0.1% at an annualized rate. And that's broken out between revolving and non-revolving credit. So revolving credit actually dropped a sharp 5.5%. Non-revolving, which covers auto and student loans, grew 2%. Seasonally adjusted outstanding balances reached about $5 trillion. $1.3 trillion of that was revolving. $3.7 trillion of that was non-revolving. Average interest rates remain very elevated. 60-month auto loans at 7.64%, 72-month loans at 7.8%. Credit card rates across all accounts averaging around 21.4%. So there's a bit of a slowdown, slight deceleration in consumer credit here. Softer household demand, more cautious borrowing. I think a lot of this can be attributed to high interest rates, moderating wage growth. I mean, it's already beginning to weigh on consumers. So there's been a pretty sharp pullback, at least on the month, in revolving credit. That suggests that households are tightening their budgets. They're reducing their discretionary spending, presumably on categories like dining, apparel, and entertainment. But there's fairly steady non-revolving credit, so indicating that there's probably still ongoing demand for durable goods and for education. And so I think that's going to support a couple of different sectors, namely kind of logistics tied to those durable goods and other service-related sectors. Now, for investors and lenders, I think restrained overall borrowing might help ease inflation pressures, might improve the case for rate cuts later in the year. But I wouldn't say that a more cautious consumer background is broadly good for CRE, noting that a lot of this leasing tied to this kind of near-term leasing and retail and rent growth could really be under pressure. But we got a little more color about why consumers are acting the way they are with the New York Fed Survey of Consumer Expectations. So this is a product of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This came out on October 7th, covering the month of September. So it is 1 month beyond the G19 data. But it showed a couple of things. Inflation expectations for consumers are increasing. 1 year ahead rate rising to 3.4 from 3.2. The 5 year outlook is up to 3. Consumers are reporting weaker earnings growth expectations, the lowest since 2021, a greater odds of losing a job, higher unemployment expectations over the next year. Household spending growth expectations are easing, so 4.7%, while income growth held steady at 2.9%. But despite softer wage outlooks, fewer respondents expect to miss debt payments. More of them expect to have easier access to credit in 2026. So again, while the G19 told us that actual consumer credit growth was slowing, Consumer expectations survey is adding a little bit more context on why households are becoming more cautious about income, becoming more cautious about employment. They have higher inflation expectations, and so confidence overall is being eroded slightly. It adds a little bit of color to the takeaway from the consumer credit data, but again, it seems like this confirms that there has been a slowdown, or that there's going to be a slowdown in non-essential purchasing. And rather than pulling back spending entirely, we're seeing some sentiment-driven slowdown. But for us in commercial real estate, I think that might translate into some steadier conditions for essential retail, again, some of the service-based tenants. But obviously, with a slowdown in discretionary spending, some softer demand, slower rent growth in sectors tied to that. But one last consumer-related indicator came out on Friday, October 10th. This is from the University of Michigan. This is the kind of most timely reading to where we are now, covered the preliminary results for the month of October, showing that overall sentiment remains unchanged month on month from September into October. This is split into two indexes, current conditions and sort of future expectations. So the current conditions index was down to 61 from 61.5. The index of consumer expectations slipped slightly to 51.2 from 52.3. One thing that they ask about as well is inflation expectations, even though this is not kind of part of the consumer sentiment index. Respondents to the survey saw a declining expectations for year ahead inflation, down from 4.7 to 4.6. And on the five-year horizon, expectations were still around 3.7%. These have remained fairly elevated since April 2nd. Now, similar to the results of this consumer expectations survey, sentiment index saw modest improvement in some of the categories they ask about tied to household finances, but these were offset by weaker expectations for the future and worsening conditions for buying durable goods, which actually runs counter to what we heard in the other survey. But this does come at the same time the G19, while of course a few months lagged, indicated steady non-revolving borrowing. So consumers are still financing big ticket items despite having a bit weaker sentiment about the future. So I think this is something we should pay attention to. There is definitely a bit of a gap between confidence or between sentiment and between actual behavior. And of course, with the government data lagging a bit, we won't get a full picture of September or October and until a few months from now for that Fed data. But I think this is something that's worth paying attention to as we close out the year and try to figure out if there really is a spending slowdown. But this was just one of the things I was taking a look at. But Omari, I think not just consumer conditions, but we want to know a little bit more about kind of business and overall financial conditions. I know that we're trying to get creative with what we look at here since we're slim on some of the government data sources. I know you were taking a look at a few other things. You want to talk about those?
Yeah, there are two other Fed-produced indices that I've dove into and tried to utilize a bit more, given that the typical data flows are a bit disrupted. But these are two indicators that are put together and released weekly that are actually aggregate indicators, compiling multiple market-based metrics into a single index. So the first indicator is the Chicago Fed's National Financial Conditions Index, or the NFCI, which is published weekly and provides a pretty comprehensive pulse check on U.S. financial market conditions. The index is based on market data from money markets, debt and equity markets, and really covers the traditional and shadow banking systems. Positive values of the NFCI indicate financial conditions are tighter than average, while negative values indicate that financial conditions are looser than average. So the NFCI through October 3rd decreased to a negative 0.55 level, indicating that the financial market conditions remain looser than average. Only two of the 105 indicators that go into and feed this index were signaling tighter than average financial conditions. So it's a very broad-based metric, but the fact that only two of the 105 are signaling tighter than average means that there's still quite a bit of reason to believe that we're in still looser conditions. The level of negative 0.55 for a kind of a point of reference, that's the loosest point that we've seen since the start of 2022, which is when U.S. interest rates started to hike. So I thought that this is one I'm going to need to explore a little bit more and better understand, but just wanted to flag that this might be a way of finding some signal through a lot of the noise that's out there. But then I thought that the NFCI, if you couple that with the Chicago Fed's if you couple the Chicago Fed's NFCI with the St. Louis Fed's Financial Stress Index, which is another weekly index which measures the degree of financial stress in markets and is constructed from 18 weekly data series, including interest rates, yield spreads, and other indicators of financial stress and de-stress, you still see this kind of sound picture of financial markets. So the St. Louis Fed's Financial Stress Index has been inching up over the last 5 months, but it's generally negative, but it is showing that we still are in this kind of period of below average levels of financial stress in the system. These are data points that are built on other data points, and we're turning attention to it because of the absence of our regular data points. Might seem a little bit convoluted, but if I had to boil it down, financial markets still very active. And by the NFCI measure or the Chicago Fed's measure, we're still in this kind of relatively loose environment. And we're not seeing we're still in a maybe not stress-free, but we're below average stress levels. But let's get out of these kind of acronyms and new metrics and get back to one of the acronyms that I think our listeners know a little bit better, which is NFIB. But Cole, why don't you share what you saw in the Small Business Economic Trends Report?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll preface this by saying that we did just get this morning. And if you've ever looked at this report, the Small Business Economic Trends Report, it is amazing that they put this out monthly. There is so much data covered in here. And so I'm going to do my best to try to boil it down because I think it gives a pretty good overview of what some of the occupiers of a lot of CRE are actually thinking in this current environment. But we did just get the report, the Small Business Economic Trends report for September. Today we're recording on the 14th. So the headline index, which is the one that often gets reported, is the Small Business Optimism Index. And it's a combination of a number of the different data points that are surveyed. And it's out of the score of 100. It fell 2 points in September to 98.8. But it was the first decline in 3 months, but it does remain above the 52-year average of 98. Interestingly, though, the uncertainty index, which is a combination of responses of don't know or unknown to a number of questions, that rose to 100, and it was up sharply. It was one of the highest readings in the 5 decades the surveys existed. Inflation and supply chain pressures reemerged in the survey. 24% of firms say they are raising prices. 31% say they're even planning future price raises. 64% of business owners reported some level of supply chain disruption. That was actually up from August, 10 points. Inflation was the top concern. 14% of respondents said so. Labor conditions were pretty tight. 32% of firms said they had an unfilled position, and that was unchanged from August. Net 16% plan to hire within the next quarter, and profit trends improved slightly. They were actually at the strongest level since 2021, but overall, owners said they were fairly cautious about near-term business conditions. There was a slight decline in optimism. There's a bit of unease among small firms. They say they're navigating inflation. They're navigating slower sales. They're having challenges with hiring. But they have a generally positive view of their own operations. So a couple of the things worth mentioning, they are worried about rising borrowing costs. They're reporting tougher loan terms. near-term tighter financial conditions. Presumably, that'll put some strain on expansion or additional capital investment. For the broader economy, I think that there's just the implication here is that there's elevated uncertainty, a bit more cautious spending by small businesses. Growth could possibly cool here toward the end of the year. So I think, again, the direct implication for CRE is that could temper a bit of leasing activity among smaller tenants in particular. I think mostly retail and office. Again, this is a big leading indicator of slowing employment growth, which we've already talked about a number of times on the podcast. But there are still some wage gains being had, which may actually help hold up baseline demand for space. But lot to unpack in that report. Happy to write some more about it in our newsletter for those who want to check that out, but did want to call out a few things. So we've wrapped up recently a debt capital market survey that I know you talked about in our conversation with Andrew, but there have been a lot of headlines recently about CRE credit trends, and we don't recap those on the show all the time. So what were some of the things that you wanted to call out in advance for our conversation with Andrew?
Yeah, and to tie back into some of the indicators that we just covered on, if you look at the national financial conditions indicators or the financial stress indicators or the survey from NFIB covering the Small Business Economic Trends Report, U.S. financial markets are open. Overall, kind of yields are coming down. There's been spread tightening for higher quality credit. There's clearly a demand for many of the borrowers, but that you still have this kind of uncertainty overhang that is present. And that's very much true in broad markets, broad credit markets, but then also within CRE financing. But there are also some CRE specific trends that I think are painting 2025 as we enter the end of the year. So credit quality appears to be stabilizing, at least for now, across CRE credit. You've seen signs of this both in the securitized space as well as balance sheet lenders and amongst the delinquency rates for balance sheet lenders. Issuance and origination activity is picking up, although I would say selectively, or there are certain areas where lenders have way more appetite and certain areas that you're still seeing much lower or below average growth rates. One point there is that U.S. securitization markets for CRE, so this is inclusive of CMBS and CRE CLOs, are really on the cusp of surpassing their entire 2024 issuance volumes in less than 10 months, or at least we still have a few months remaining in 2025. So it looks like we're going to be closing the year out with a much higher level of issuance than in 2024. But also in CRE debt space, there's been a shift this year in terms of who's lending, right? So non-bank lending really is accounting for about 35% of all CRE lending, with CMBS and CRE CLOs accounting for more than one-fifth of all new origination activity. And if you look at the non-bank lending category of funds and mortgage REITs, they currently account for about 1 in 7 new loans. That's up from about 1 in 10 a few years back, or just 2 years back. While banks are still a bit sluggish to return to the markets, but we are seeing signs of them coming back. As Cole noted, we did finish our U.S. debt capital markets survey, which closed on the 30th of September. And one of the interesting pieces that came out of that was the number of quotes that borrowers are getting for new loans or for refinancings. They're currently getting 5 or more quotes. That's up almost double from what they were getting a year ago. And so to me, that's a sign of really growing lender appetite to finance CRE deals. But with all of this said, these are all positive signs for CRE lending activity to really be coming back. You can't talk about CRE debt without talking about the banks. And while there are some signs of them coming off the sidelines to a degree, you really see that selectivity in bank loan growth rates really being focused on multifamily and shunning the construction and development activities. But the reason why I think banks are critical to watch is because they account for about half of the outstanding CRE debt that's out there. So about half of that $6.2 trillion that is outstanding. I think we're at the start of a big kind of data dump on the bank CRE lending activities. As we're recording on the 14th, bank earnings just kicked off today with many of the major banks reporting, even though they don't usually break out CRE trends, but we'll be getting many of the regional banks, which do have much larger exposures to CRE. They'll be reporting over the next couple of weeks, as well as we should be seeing the SLOOS or the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey later this week or early next, which is a great indicator of what banks are loosening or tightening their underwriting standards and overall kind of aggregate demand for CRE loans. But I know there was also a piece that captured a bit of attention, at least in the media this week, coming from the St. Louis Fed. Cole, what was that piece and what were they saying there?
Yeah, so this was just a short data-centric blog piece that the St. Louis Fed put out talking about some CRE loan modification data. And I think it caught some attention because there were some fairly eye-popping numbers in there, or one fairly eye-popping number in there. But also, you just don't see the data pulled from call reports to talk about modifications very often. And so the headline figure that was talked about in a handful of media publications was that there was a 66% increase in CRE loan modifications over the last four quarters. This came directly from call report data that was then cleaned by members of the St. Louis Fed, but this was up from $16.7 billion at the end of Q2 2024 to $27.7 billion at the end of Q2 2025. So thought this was fairly interesting. One of the pieces that was buried in there was that they did say that modifications as a percentage of the overall CRE books of banks is actually still historically fairly low. I've seen some numbers cited as 1.5%, 2%, a little hard to calculate without knowing exactly what they're pulling here. But one of the other things that I think is worth mentioning is that there are some upcoming changes to the reporting rules. And so there have been some kind of other folks who looked at this data and figured that one of the reasons that the Q2 2025 data annually may have shown a big jump is that folks were trying to get those in and then have them roll off, say, within the next 12 months before they have to report them again. And so that could be a reason that you would see a big jump prior to the new rule. But if folks want to check that out, I'm sure we could link to that in the show notes, but definitely caught some attention. I think it'll be another topic of conversation coming up here in the next few months.
And as CRE debt, one thing that we say on the research team is debt drives equity. And so it's critically important to understand what lenders are doing, because usually they are driving investment activity, which then also helps provide price discovery and builds momentum. In the topic of CRE debt, we wanted to check in with another Altus expert who is focused on debt. And so to really help shed light on some of the recent trends and what he's seen in the CRE debt space, we had a chance to catch up with Andrew Pabon. Let's go over to that conversation now.
Omar, thanks very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to the discussion here today. Again, my name is Andrew Pabon. I'm a director here at Altus Group, focused on valuations, primarily focused on debt valuations for CRE. That encompasses both the receivables or lender side, as well as the payables or more so equity side. And I've been having that focus here for the last six or so years, leading up a group that is primarily focused on debt valuation mark to market on a quarterly basis for many, again, of those lender receivable funds or equity payable funds. Today, that encompasses about 1,800 loans, a little over 120 funds. So similar to our equity brethren on the Altus advisory side, helping with many of those valuation needs that our clients need for various different purposes on multiple different frequencies.
Awesome. And is that predominantly balance sheet lenders? Is that funds that are buying existing credit?
So it's a combination. I would say in the equity side, and really across both. These are institutional investors consistent with kind of our general bread and butter on the equity side of the Altus Advisory House, focused on, let's call it, more high-level institutional quality commercial real estate. So any of the mortgage payables associated with those assets in particular. And then likewise, on the lender side, these can be insurance companies, life co's, other different types of investors that are focused on primarily value-add transitional type loans and providing that bridge financing in many instances before moving to something that's more permanent.
So you have an awesome kind of perspective through the client portfolios of what is happening in CRE debt. And so that's exactly why we wanted to have you on today to do a quick pulse check on what you're seeing in terms of either changes in the market or across the CRE debt landscape. One thing that we work on together is the quarterly debt capital market survey, which we closed out for the third quarter. Do you mind providing a quick overview of either the survey or just how you use it and the types of insights that you draw from that survey?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a survey that another one of our directors, Jason Chelfie, helped launch early last year in 2024, and we've been keeping it running and growing since. The main focus there is to reach out to many capital markets participants, many of our clients who are involved in the commercial real estate space, and obviously in particular, the commercial real estate debt space. So trying to get better insight and information and get a sense of what's happening in the capital markets perspective, what's happening with spreads today relative to the various property types across commercial real estate debt. It's intended to serve a couple of major purposes. One being obviously being able to put that back out to all of those contributors to share, obviously, the information that many of their peers are also coming up and presenting within the survey itself. And then likewise on our side, you know, it's one of the many tools that we utilize as we go through that debt mark-to-market valuation exercise each quarter or each month, depending on, again, some of those client necessities or mandates from a valuation perspective.
And what jumped out in this latest survey to you, or what were some of the key kind of takeaways that caught your attention?
Yep, key takeaways, and I'll keep this maybe a little bit more general, given there's some unique things that are happening at specific LTV levels or specific property types. But in general, I'd say the main takeaway is some of that spread compression. So I think a lot of the contributors and participants for the survey are showing us with the data that they're providing that things are coming in. We're seeing a little bit of that spread tightening. I wouldn't say that's anything too drastic, but the numbers are pretty much showing, if we're looking on a mean and median basis, that many of those spreads are coming in on a quarter over quarter basis. So maybe to put that in context and a little bit of a backdrop, in general, commercial real estate valuations on the equity or the collateral side have been pretty flat for the most part. And obviously you and the team have touched on this for a period of time now. And from a debt perspective, a fair amount of volatility when it comes to indices, but spread-wise, also relatively flat or stable. So started to hear a bit about potential spread compression over the course of the summer, anecdotally from clients and different valuation processes that we're involved with, but likewise from some of the originations that ultimately end up within our valuation scope, all pointing in that direction. And I think the survey coming in at the very end of third quarter is further validation of some of those trends that we have been seeing and hearing about from many of our clients.
And one of the themes I think really was popping up in earlier surveys and was a key theme of 2024 was this lack of availability of financing, right? So you had higher cost of financing that was available, but then an overall kind of absence within the debt space of providing new capital to commercial real estate. However, one thing that's jumped out in the last, at least, you know, three surveys of 2025 is that it appears as though more and more quotes are being given, more and more lenders are actually participating in the survey, which I think that's a sign by itself that capital is coming back.
Absolutely. And I think that is a little bit of the shift from all of the capital that's been sitting on the sidelines. Obviously, there have been people on both the equity and credit side that have been looking to place it. There have been various different things that happened over the course of this year so far that have resulted in a pause or in a sit back and wait approach. And once much of that, I think, got cleared up, at least to an extent, and in conjunction with how things have generally been changing and being revised from an economic print standpoint, obviously resulting in most recent in the last few weeks, you know, a Fed rate cut, that has all been part of the background and fundamentals to start to free up some of that capital, in particular on the credit side. So again, that general statement of spread compression, maybe digging into a little bit more of those key highlights that you're requesting, is absolutely in residential or multifamily and industrial, which has really been the two property types that we've continued to see originations from on the lender side, even over the last 2 years. So that's been one place, I think, of safety and continual liquidity that has been ever present. But what is interesting in this latest iteration of the survey is seeing that overall positive sentiment and interest in potentially placing some more of that liquidity and capital to work is with that general spread compression commentary that I've included. Obviously, the new highlight there is related to office, where we've seen some of those spreads come in as well. And likewise, have seen, heard from our clients, new, more quotes being provided to them for some of that highly occupied, higher WALT, basically better office product that still has basically a place in the commercial real estate kind of environment and has some interest around it. But I think that's an interesting thing to note in particular for the third quarter iteration. Likewise, if you look at some of the ranges across the different property types, industrial resi, where there's been that continued liquidity, somewhat tighter ranges on a quarter over quarter basis. And you've seen a little bit more of that marked movement, more on those long duration fixed rate spread quotes that were provided. I think, again, providing a little bit of that indication of being able to have more of that clarity and wanting to lock in something that's a little bit longer term versus the last few years where, you know, much of the debt that's been placed has been much more shorter term. And that's even on the fixed rate side, looking at more of those 5 and 7 year deals. Whereas, again, potentially a leading indicator from the survey is maybe now shifting a little bit more back towards that longer term paper with some of the information here that we've seen on a spread basis.
I love it. And I guess, what are you watching for through the fourth quarter and closing this year out?
Absolutely. I think more of, and obviously a government shutdown and higher level economic data pending and withstanding, getting some more of that clarity through the end of the year, which obviously is also what the Fed is looking for, and the potential for, let's call it at least a couple more rate cuts through the end of the year, all from a commercial real estate perspective, is expected to result in increased transactions, increased liquidity, again, even more of that capital coming off the sidelines. So to the extent that those changes occur, those events happen as the market expects, I personally would anticipate potentially some more of this spread compression that, yes, absolutely, there's those two components, supply and demand side, more so on the supply side, to the extent that more of that capital is coming off the sidelines and we're getting even more players involved with trying to place and put funds out there, that could lead to further spread compression. Again, benchmark indices aside, that could make things here very competitive. And again, pick up overall transaction activity for commercial real estate.
Andrew, you've shared how your team uses some of the survey insights, but what are some of the benefits that the contributors to the survey or the survey participants get from this survey?
I think the main thing is pretty timely information on obviously not only what they themselves are, but their peers are seeing in the market, and that it can expand out to, again, different types of debt. Our survey covers fixed, floating. We touch a little bit on warehouse facility leverage information as well. So the fact that they can potentially get more information, more insight in other areas that they are not specifically focused on is always something that is probably massively helpful to them, to give them broader overall takes on what's happening, you know, in the credit space where they're most intimately involved. So I think that's one of the greatest takeaways. And aside from that, potentially raising new questions for them to ask. Obviously, they can come to Altus to ask some of those questions that we can hopefully try to discern and unpack, bringing in together both the credit and equity data and information that we have available here at Altus. So again, being another potential window or insight.
So you almost get to see the full capital stack perspective. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's fair. So being able to come to Altus and ask those questions and us to provide a little bit more context and bridge those two components of debt and equity is one of the benefits that we have here at Altus, touching valuations on both sides.
I love that. And how do people get involved? How do they get access to these results?
So involvement, we do have now a very nice new shiny landing page that has some of the information there related to our survey and also has the opportunity for you to provide your information to sign up to participate for future iterations. As a reminder, this is completed on a quarterly basis. Likewise, if you know or anyone has forwarded along to you the kickoff email, you can happily kind of respond to that and we'll get you plugged in on the list. Likewise, you have some of our contact information here from listening here on the podcast. Omar, the marketing team, Jason Cheffy are all open. So please feel free to shoot any of us an email and we will happily add you to the list. And then obviously the main benefit of being a contributor is getting fully unredacted results of this survey. So obviously we're giving that information back to those who have helped complete and input the information that's being now presented in this final survey.
So a huge thank you to Andrew for joining us and sharing his perspective on the CRE debt landscape. Now, we got a bunch of releases and earnings coming up this week and over the next couple of weeks. Cole, what are we paying attention to?
Yes, despite the government shutdown, if that persists through the next week, we will get a handful of different releases. And Monday the 20th, U.S. leading economic indicators. On Thursday, October 23rd, existing home sale data from the National Association of Realtors. And Friday, October 24th, if the shutdown is resolved, likely the consumer price index. Otherwise, we'll get the final readout for consumer sentiment in October from the University of Michigan and the S&P Flash U.S. Purchasing Managers Indexes for October as well. And I know there will be some earnings calls as well, so we'd be happy to share the schedule for those or the calendar for those for folks in the newsletter. But Omar, other than that, I think that's all the time we have today. Before we sign off, I do want to encourage listeners, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it, give us 5 stars on Apple or Spotify, leave us comments there as well. We'd be happy to read them. Or feel free to just send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.